This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Mosquitoes can make being outside at this time of the year very unpleasant. But that's not why understanding mosquito behavior is so important. Mosquitoes are by far the deadliest animal threat to humans. Malaria alone kills 400,000 people every year. And mosquitoes can also carry yellow fever, dengue fever, and encephalitis. In the United States, mosquitoes spread West Nile virus, Eastern equine encephalitis, and Zika viruses. Understanding why mosquitoes bite and when is critical to stemming these diseases. Recently, biologists at the University of Cincinnati announced some breakthroughs in understanding mosquito activity and are working with counterparts at the College of Medicine to utilize those insights. We are joined today by the Assistant Professor of Biological Sciences at the University of Cincinnati College of Arts and Sciences, Professor Joshua Benoit, and Associate Chairman of Medicine for Translational Research and Professor of Clinical Medicine at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine, Dr. Carl Fichtenbaum. To join our discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email WVXU, email us at mailtalk@wvxu.org. We are on Facebook and Twitter as well. Welcome to both of you. So glad to have you here. Dr. Fichtenbaum, the reported cases of what are called vector-borne diseases, viruses, bacteria, parasites, whatever, that are carried by mosquitoes, ticks, fleas, have tripled nationwide in the United States from about 27,400 cases in 2004 to 96,000 cases plus in 2016. Why? What's going on here?
Well, I think there's a number of different things that are happening that explain the numbers. Number one, we are seeing a true increase in the number of different diseases and the amount of people being infected by these diseases. Number two, we're getting better and better at making the diagnosis. And so our diagnostic tools are much better in this decade than previous decades. In the 1990s, 1980s, we were not quite as good.
So that increase may not be as sharp as it first looks.
Right, because we're also more aware. Also, as everyone knows, since this is the social media millennium that we're in, I think everybody is more aware of this. There's much more information out there. And there's much more ready information so that humans are a lot more aware of these problems and will go to their doctor to get it checked out. So it's true we're seeing a real increase in the numbers, but there are other reasons why we're better at making the diagnosis.
Okay. And Dr. Benoit, there the traditional understanding of why mosquitoes particularly bite people, what is that? Why do they bite humans and other mammals, for that matter?
Well, the main reason that mosquitoes actually will bite anybody is only the females will do it, and they need the blood for the protein and lipids to make eggs. And so most vectors, that's the main reason they bite anybody. Okay. And so just to get a protein and lipid source to make eggs, because a lot of them, mosquitoes will also feed on nectar, so they'll feed on flowers and get nectar sources from there, but they only get sugar. And so without the blood meal, they can't reproduce.
Okay. So they need it in a real biological sense.
Yes.
But you've done some research that indicates that the frequency with which mosquitoes will bite hosts of various types is not just driven by that. It's driven by other factors as well.
Yeah. We've been really interested in figuring out how periods of drought affect mosquitoes. And there's been a lot of disease modeling. So people have been trying to figure out why, for example, West Nile virus increases in certain areas. And the one major factor they found is it seems to be drought or periods of dryness, which isn't what you would expect. People think it always needs to be wetter to have more mosquitoes. There's more water they reproduce, but that's not the case. And so for a lot of mosquitoes, if they are experiencing these periods of drought, they get dehydrated, and then that pushes them to blood feed more often, which could lead to increased disease transmission.
So sort of the traditional understanding was one of the things that you should do is to make sure you clean up any little pools of water, old tires, bird baths, get rid of all of that. But this is sort of runs counter to that, right, Dr. Fichtenbaum?
Well, it may run counter to that, but I still think those are breeding grounds. So there's probably no reason why the empty flower pot or the tire in the backyard that's filled with water, I think you should still get rid of those. But I think what Justin's really talking about is much more about the ecological changes overall. What's the ground and the earth like? So it's not just a simple thing like, is there any water around? It's what's happening in the overall geography in the earth and how things are changing. We saw a dramatic change in West Nile virus as it went from the East Coast across the United States. And that's a very interesting change that we've seen with a lot of vector-borne diseases, that their habitats have been changing. And so research looking at drought and changes in the environment, the amount of moisture that's available in the earth and the amount available for all the insects is very, very important for understanding how they're going to behave and what diseases we might accidentally come in contact with.
So how have they changed as they've moved across the United States to these different?
It depends on the species. Like as of right now, there's ticks moving across the U.S. So we're getting more Ixodes deer ticks that are moving across and taking Lyme disease with them into areas where it was previously absent. So you can get, as they move across the U.S., like with West Nile virus, as they're making that path, there's people that have never been exposed, people and animal. So they're more likely to get it. You see these higher increases. Then once it goes through and it kind of establishes in those areas, then it kind of reaches a nice baseline level and kind of stays at that period of time without these drastic increases that you saw in the initial wave of West Nile virus.
So
There's another factor too, which is the population and its relationship to the areas of which we live. There's tremendous deforestation that occurs and also urbanization that occurs. And we are pushing these populations of different species and animals into different places. And they migrate just like humans migrated many years ago. And so now we have diseases that only existed one time in Connecticut have made their way across to Ohio, to Missouri, and other places, and vice versa, going in different directions. So everything that we do and the animals do has an impact on what we get exposed to.
And I think that's one of the things that's kind of interesting here, thinking about insects and sort of reacting the same way other animals that we know. I mean, there's all kinds of nature shows that people might watch that talk about the changes in habitat that are available and how that pushes deer certain places. But insects being the same thing, they have to change their habits, and that has implications for us. So what about climate change? Is that a factor here? I mean, drought? You're talking about drought?
Oh, it's a major factor. So we're seeing vectors that were previously only in southern areas or you'd only see as north as Tennessee start moving upward, moving north towards Cincinnati. We used to only find about one species of tick, which was dog ticks, present around Cincinnati. Now we're finding three and maybe even four now. And so it used to only be just dog ticks, but it's these changing geographic distributions can have a major effect with climate change.
So do different species carry different diseases?
Yes.
And they're very specific to various diseases?
There are some ticks and occasional mosquitoes that carry more than one germ inside of them that can be accidentally imposed upon a human being. But many of them only carry one. But each tick or mosquito is really set up perfectly for the replication cycle of some of these germs. And they don't kill the species. They're really an intermediate. There is a different host, for example, a mouse or a rodent or a deer or a dog that may be a host of some particular problem, that when there's a meal with a tick or a mosquito, then they have it in their system and they're able to deposit in their saliva as they come and accidentally bite us. So it's a very interesting situation.
Well, before we have to take a break, one of the things I want to ask about is you operate a mosquito lab.
Yes.
Now, this is radio, so we can't show things, but how do you study mosquitoes? And what are you doing here?
They're pretty easy to study. They can fly, so you have to keep them in cages. So we have about 20,000 to 25,000 mosquitoes in different size cages, about 4 to 5 species.
When we're talking cages, covered by
nets? Screens, like window screens.
Window screens.
So
okay.
Rather than keeping them out of the house, I'm keeping them in their cages. And so we rear all these different species. We have to grow them from larva in the water to adult. And then we have to keep these numbers up to do all these experiments. And they're behind double doors, so any accidental releases never escape. And it's a very unique lab environment because your organism, if it gets out, it will bite you.
No, especially if they've been dehydrated, right?
Yeah, even more so.
Yeah. So, and how many people work in your lab?
About probably 15.
So this is a big lab. This is a big study that you've got.
Yeah,
going
and
on.
They work on everything that ranges from ticks all the way to mosquitoes, and then even some work on some cockroaches too.
Oh well, yeah. One of my other favorites. So let's talk about some of the diseases that are out there that I think everybody has heard about. What's sort of the state of Lyme disease at this point in this area?
So we see it rising. It's been increasing, and I think in part because our testing is better and people are more aware, but also because now we're starting to see the ticks that carry Lyme disease in almost every county. They're a bit more congregated in some of the more forested eastern parts of Ohio, but we're seeing increasing numbers of cases every year. So we're over 200 every year now in the state of Ohio, and I expect that to continue to rise.
And what happens if you contract Lyme disease? What are the symptoms you ought to be looking for?
Yeah, so for most of the diseases that come from mosquitoes and ticks, there are some commonalities. Fever, headache, muscle aches are often very common. Occasionally, people get nausea and vomiting. For Lyme disease, at the site where you have the tick bite, you may actually get a unique rash that's called erythema marginatum. It's a target type of rash with a sort of central clearing, almost looking a little bit like a bullseye. So that's the one thing that may help you identify that. But for most of the diseases, there may not be a distinct rash or appearance, and you just really need to go see your doctor.
For Lyme disease, what's the treatment?
The treatments are fairly similar for all of these. Actually, the most common treatment for any of the early infections we see from ticks or mosquitoes is doxycycline, which can be used both in adults and in children. And most of the diseases that are treatable really respond to that if you catch them early enough.
Dr. Benoit, what about Zika? I mean, this was a major headline producer a few years ago. Where are we on that?
It's still a major disease, and it popped up in South America about a year or two ago with a large number of cases that were linked to microcephaly, so babies born with a smaller head. And it's still there. It's still being transmitted, but they're not getting the levels that they initially did, the number of cases. That's mainly because with any new disease, it usually has a lot of infections the first year, maybe a little bit less the next year, and then kind of eventually reaches this kind of equilibrium within the population. And you still should be worried about it, but it's not quite at the levels it was a year or two ago.
Okay. We have a number of callers, but I want to make sure that we get them in. Lynn has called. Lynn, do you have a question?
I do. I wanted to know if I know that bed bugs do not carry disease, apparently, but I wanted to know if your lab has any room to also study those.
For bed bugs?
I'd love to find a way to get rid of them.
So I actually used to do a lot of bed bug research, and I actually co-directed a large group that sequenced the bed bug genome 2 years ago. And we still do some work on them, but not really as much, mainly because there's not a lot of funding for bed bug research because they don't transmit diseases, which is kind of a sad state, but it's just how it is. And so I know there's a lot of groups that are doing work on their mating and pesticide resistance, hoping to develop better ways to control them.
Okay. And so they really don't carry any diseases. It's just really pest.
Very annoying and itchy.
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Lynn. Kyle has also called in, and Kyle has a question. What would you like to ask, Kyle?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I guess my question is, I'm an environmental studies graduate student. I've done a lot of work on climate change as far as presentations and everything. And I understand that a lot of these insects are, you know, going into colder climates as the Earth warms. But a lot of my research has been on rewilding initiatives, especially in the United States. And I was wondering, I hadn't thought about, since when you guys mentioned, deforestation causing these insects to migrate into these other areas. If we were to begin these rewilding initiatives with these areas that have been deforested, is there any way to put these insects back into their natural habitat? Like, will they return, or is this just something that we're conceivably stuck with for as long as human beings are on this planet?
So the question really is, once you've disrupted the environment, yeah, can you put it back together?
So, you know, we really saw about a decade or so ago the onset of West Nile virus across the United States, initially reported in the state of New York. And then from that time, it kind of spread across the United States. And what we found is that we really haven't gotten rid of any of the habitats for that. And there are still mosquitoes that carry West Nile virus here in Ohio. The numbers of cases, though, dropped dramatically as the population developed immunity to West Nile virus. So we don't see nearly as many cases as we did, say, 10 years ago. I don't think that once you have a mosquito or a tick that has found a niche in a habitat, that it's quite as easy to get them unrooted and uprooted from that habitat. It seems to be much easier for them to come in than to go away. But I would leave it to Dr. Benoit to get the last word on that.
I'm pretty sure once you've modified the habitat, for example, you have deer ticks, you have all these new subdivisions out on the edge of the suburbs in these wooded areas. The ticks are there. The people are there. They're going to feed on the raccoons, possums, foxes in those areas. So they're probably permanently there at that point, and people are going to be permanently getting exposed to them.
So given that, what should people do to protect themselves? We talked about, you know, once you've got it, you need to see your doctor if you are experiencing those symptoms. But what can you do to prevent getting bit?
There's a lot of different ways. And so I'll start with more of a habitat way. For example, ticks, they like certain habitats in your backyard and those sort of things. So you can modify the habitats. You can put areas where you're not that aren't conducive to tick survival, or you can get rid of large pools of water and those sort of things, which will reduce mosquito populations. So there's the habitat modification that you can do in order to prevent them from even being there. And then I'll let Carl answer about DEET.
Yeah, so I think, first of all, a couple of simple things, which is if you don't want to get bit by mosquitoes, dawn and dusk are the peak times that they tend to bite, so you can stay indoors. Wearing long sleeve clothing, long pants, things like that prevents them from biting quite so much. If you're going to be outside, there are a number of different natural and human-made repellents that you can use around the environment to keep them away. And certainly DEET is one of the things that people commonly use. And so I think those are things you can do pretty well to make sure that you try and avoid the biting. The other thing is when you're out and about in nature, you should always do a tick check. when you come back in the house, it's important to check your children. I think that's a very critical sort of thing. If you find a tick, the simplest thing to do is take a tweezers, go right to where the head is embedded and pull it out. Don't use any of these crazy techniques of, you know, putting alcohol, nail polish remover, trying to burn them off. That's when we see people come in with burns and problems like that. So just try to get rid of the tick using a tweezers.
I guess I've always heard, though, that the fear of that was you were going to leave the head embedded. You would take the body off and the head was going to be there and the infection would still come.
Well, it's almost worse, particularly if it's been feeding a while and you burn them or put the alcohol in them, they will actually start to spit into you more.
Oh, good.
And so you actually want to reach in, and that's why it's important to reach all the way into your skin and get the entire mouth parts and every piece of it. Chances are you're probably going to remove a little tiny bit of your skin along with the head of a tick if it's been feeding a while.
And how important is it to get that tick quickly?
Oh, it's very, very important. If you can get the tick off of you within 4 hours of them coming, the likelihood of any disease transmission is dramatically reduced. If they're on for more than 24 hours, that's when the likelihood of disease transmission really occurs.
Okay. We have another call from Greg. And Greg, you have a call, you have a question or a comment about bed bugs?
Yeah, I hate to bring the conversation back inside because the tick issue is very, very important. But it came to my attention that there was research that was published in 2014 that showed that bed bugs were capable of carrying the virus for Chagas disease. And, you know, I know it might be in the realm of a remote possibility of somebody contracting that disease from bed bugs. But I just wanted to throw that question out there, given the comments that bed bugs don't carry any disease at all.
So it's Chagas disease. It's a parasite that's usually transmitted by kissing bugs. And so they had shown some studies in 2014 that bed bugs could carry it and even potentially defecate it out. And so in order to get infected with Chagas disease, the bugs, the kissing bugs, will bite a person, then defecate the parasite onto their skin, then they scratch it and become infected. The issue with bed bugs is they'll likely never transmit it because they usually don't defecate while feeding on the host. So even though there's a possibility that they might, it's very, very unlikely.
Okay. So it's there. It's been studied, but it's unlikely at this point. There's other things to be worrying about.
Yes.
There's other ticks. What about fleas? We haven't talked specifically about fleas, but certainly with animals being outside this time of the year too, is that possibility of bringing fleas in? And what should people be aware of in that situation? Anything special?
The only thing special is with the fleas, this is usually a time of the year a lot of people will get fleas because their dogs are out more. The fleas are more likely to survive outside because it's more conducive. It's not freezing outside. And so usually if you get the fleas, you can either take them to the vet, get treated there, or you can use some sort of one of the preventative medications that actually prevent flea reproduction. So it may not kill them right away, but it'll prevent the fleas from reproducing more.
I know that there was all this literature that I got sent getting ready for this. I saw plague mentioned several times.
The fleas that we see commonly in the United States and the ones on dogs really don't transmit many diseases at all.
Okay.
But it is the fleas that are actually responsible for the transmission of Yersinia pestis. And those are fleas that we only see attached to rodents and small mammals. And that tends to congregate a little bit more in the southwest United States. So we don't see a lot of that here in Ohio.
Okay. So where is your research going at this point?
So my work right now is we're trying to focus on how periods of drought and starvation impact disease transmission and host preference of mosquitoes and ticks. And so that's what we're looking at right now with the idea of seeing if chemicals such as DEET still work under these – if a mosquito is dehydrated, will the DEET still work? And so we're kind of looking a little bit at those factors right now.
So what has been sort of the go-to for a long time, You're trying to find out if it's been compromised.
Not even if it's been compromised. It just maybe it just quite doesn't work. It just doesn't work as well. And we're trying to figure out these full aspects and see kind of get these big encompassing views on how environment impacts the transmission of vector-borne diseases.
Well, this has been really interesting. I would love to see your lab, by the way. I just the photos I've seen of the lab.
And I would love for you to see his lab, but not me.
Not you. Okay. Maybe just the pictures. Okay. So I want to thank Drs. Fichtenbaum and Benoit.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on the website wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.